Hello, and welcome to Season 6 of the Bees and Honey podcast. The weather is getting warmer and people are going out. Whatever your point of view about our current world situation, life is getting back to as close to normal as we can describe it right now. And today we have an artist who is part of all the worlds that we've seen affected by this current pandemic. He was born in the Caribbean in Jamaica. He's a professor in Boston, Massachusetts, and he has had a studio in Beijing, China. I hope you enjoy this episode with Brian McFarlane.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. I'm glad we found the time to talk again about your art.
Yes. And if I have the phone in my hand, is it okay, the phone?
Yeah, that should work very well.
So we won't do the live image then on a computer. Okay.
Yes. All right. So tell us about your new exhibition that's up now at Gallery Naga or Naga Gallery in Boston. Mm-hmm. Caught in Colorful Rain is a beautiful exhibition title, I think.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's about beauty and it's about transcending during the corona period here. The negativity, the idea of death, and more about a degree of cleansing and that of line, light and color being enjoyed on an emotional level by all. I want people to grasp that a sense of a positive and a sense of hope by looking at those paintings is possible. They are somewhat abstract, so, and they're about the rain and water elements, so they're not complex in that sense. They're fairly straightforward, but the technical approach is complex. Yeah.
Well, tell us how this work is different from older bodies of work. For people who don't know what your work looks like, perhaps you could describe it for them.
Oh, well, in general, I started out largely as a figurative painter, and these works are kind of opposite in the sense that they are not loaded with the kind of human figure or figurative content that I normally have put in my work for a number of years. Mm-hmm. These are more a kind of extraction of the essence of something essential about life and spirit and survival and beauty. And so these pieces, normally I am inspired by travel. My work is informed by travel. Mm-hmm. And again, so these works, our current work, essentially are about a reflection of my childhood days as well, as well as kind of climate and water element in nature and how we interact with that.
And the color palette, I mean, how, I know you said it's about rain, but tell us a little bit about the colors that you chose and just the size of the canvases, stuff like that.
Yeah, where the color is concerned, I chose to work with a large degree of raw and kind of colors. I didn't want to mute those colors too much. I just wanted them to be as raw at times as possible as a way of engaging and engaging in this sumptuous idea of color and the way children probably use color in a very direct manner. Being from the Caribbean and having experienced the lush, the beauty of a sunset, the copious showers of rain, and playing in that rain while it was on, while it came down copiously, as well as the sun being out while the rain was falling, in many cases where the light and the prismatic quality of the rain become very resplendent with almost like diamond and a sort of beauty that is reflected to that kind of a kind of prism of a diamond or so. So I wanted to grasp and express the poetics of space and color in that regard, the experience of color. And so that I think all of us at some point, especially between the ages of during 5D or during our childhood, we kind of responded to color in some profound manner. And I feel as if sometimes we're afraid of it in our adulthood when a given color stands out. For example, Black people stand out a lot when we're Black, and people, you know, and that's a beautiful color. And you know, I don't want to run away. I want to embrace color and the beauty of it, and all those colors. As I was contemplating while I'm painting, if you mix all those colors together, that painting. If you mix them on the palette together, they become Black. So ultimately, Black absorbs all color. And as a color, in terms of a theoretical idea, be it look from the standpoint of Munsell, Isaac Newton, or any of these colorists, Barnard or so, they understood that concept. And so I wanted to just be expressive with color and to turn nature in no uncertain term to express nature and my emotion unabatedly.
Yes, well, I was going to ask you where you made this body of work. Did you create it in Boston for this show?
Yes, about half of them are created in Boston and the other half in Beijing. I have a studio in Beijing, as some people might know. Mm-hmm. I work there quite often every year. Mm-hmm. The only year I've not gone there because of the COVID. Mm-hmm. The largest paintings were done in Beijing. Mm-hmm. I did a large number of these works, even though I'm just showing a tiny amount. I'm showing about maybe 13, 12 works in the exhibition. Mm-hmm. I probably have done about 30 pieces or more in this series. And the works in terms of dimension you asked early on, some of them are up to like 13 feet by 10 feet or 12 feet.
So generally large, yeah.
Generally large works, an average of maybe 12 by 8. And you know, I feel as if when you open up space, it gives you a chance to show something about immensity, about how things are expanded, and a chance for you to move your body physically, to make marks and to express ideas that if you sit down and like you're writing, that's a whole different way of making marks and creating symbols. But if your body is involved, where you move your arm, your legs, and you twist and turn, it becomes a whole different kind of experience, a physicality that is essential to somehow showing the dominance and power of nature and how I, as a human being, an artist, experience them.
Yes. So what was it like as an artist living and working in Beijing, as an artist of color in particular?
Well, as an artist of color, sometime I must confess that the experience was quite strange, you know, in a way that China and places in the East are not always that used to seeing a lot of Black people. Or even, well, I felt in a way the opposite side, like, you know, the pirates went to the Caribbean and did a lot of stuff. And I guess I was a pirate in China, trying to conquer and learn and immerse. But, you know, on a serious note, socially, you know, at times I felt very welcome by the art community, the creative community, families, individuals, and so on. Extremely Because I think racism, while racism and so on and might exist all over the world, the psychology of racism also exists in China, but in a different way that it can be looked at in an historical context than, say, you know, the racism in the United States or the racism in France or the British racism, which is always covered with a lot of manners. And, and you know, kind of like elegance, which you probably not, might not notice it's a time in Britain. So
like what we're seeing, differently.
It's in China as well. And it's more about isolation because that culture was isolated for many years and did not interrupt or go into other people's culture and bother them. So in a unique way, when the intervention of another race comes into play in their culture, their racism has a certain dissonance and at the same time, a kind of nationalism that is understood.
Yes. And now going back to your roots in Jamaica, I know you received one of Jamaica's top accolades about 10 years ago. Can you tell us about that prize and about your time in Jamaica growing up as an artist and how you moved from there to the U.S. and started your practice as well as your academic career?
Yeah, Jamaica is a primary basis on which I sprung into the rest of the world. And as a so-called, I am, you know, in Jamaica, I would be seen as a Maroon. I come from the Maroon tribe of people who largely were the people who conquered the British and kicked them out, rather, the colonial powers. And also, even though they betrayed themselves and their own people at times, but they were the one who largely carved out a legacy so that Black people could live with a certain a degree of freedom. So I'm from the Maroon, and that's around the mountainous section of Jamaica, very beautiful. That informs my psyche in the deepest sense and my sense of ancestry, because that which comes from the Akan people in Ghana, who were not submissive people. They were, unlike, say, the Bantu people, a lot of the people who live in the south of the United States. Maroons were from the northeast of Ghana, and they were extremely rebellious and did not give in to slavery at all. So they conquered the Blue Mountains and stayed there in the Portland area of Jamaica in the west. And going to art school, I was very aware of those things. My grandfather, Colonel Harris, who was one of the colonel or lead of the Maroons, he talked with me a lot. He spoke Twi, which is the original language from Ghana, one of the native language. He was an extremely educated person. I think he spoke 12 languages. And he was very, led his people and gave them a certain amount of comfort during the post-colonial era in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. He died just about 2 years ago. Going to art school, you know, going to leaving that mountainous area and then going to Kingston to live sort of changed me and made me a little more city-wise and city boy type. I got a scholarship to the Jamaica School of Art when I was probably in my third form in high school. And I also did my A levels and O levels in third form and passed them with distinction. So I decided to I would go to art school. I mean, it was, you know, the third form status normally don't take the GCO level, which is university level, level for Cambridge exam in London. I was so passionate about art that I passed all those things. I was probably, I don't know, 14, 15, 15 years old. And normally until you're 17, 18, 19. And I left art school and at a few shows. I didn't feel too satisfied with just being on the island. I wanted to go and see original works in both Africa, in Europe, in and so after leaving, I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to the Royal College of Art. Then I went on to the United States and did my master's in US. given some opportunities by Northeastern University to have a studio. So that kind of seduced me and made me stay a little longer in the U.S. having a studio, because that's all I felt I needed. I didn't even know I needed anything else. And then later on, I was invited as well as interviewed for work for a professorship. I was offered a professorship in I remember the 80s, and I remember the Institute of Contemporary Art asked me to do a show, two shows. And, you know, I remember David Ross and Elizabeth Sussman were directors at ICA then. David Ross, they curated my work at ICA, and people like Matthew Teichelbaum. And so those things encouraged me and say, okay, you know, seduce me a little to stay in America and kind of stay longer and to take some part-time positions in teaching. And then, of course, I ended up getting tenured as at the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth after teaching at Holy Cross and places like the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. So the tenure kind of is something that keeps you kind of quiet. It kind of attempts to put you in a sort of ivory tower, so that you might lose. Sometimes you can lose touch with real life. But I tried being actively working on my, that connected me to the world outside a lot. So I had no other option but to listen to my calling as an artist, just as a visual artist, and not so much as an academic. The academic work was great. It taught me a lot. I learned a lot about people. I was able to teach the master's degree level. I directed many, many theses. And I have, and do have many students who are quite successful now, some of which are at the School of Art teaching now. I recruited students as a strategy from the Jamaica School of Art to come and do their master's here, because there's an MFA program in Jamaica. And then they go back and teach in Jamaica and develop our art school there, of which about three of my students are now both the chair of departments and working, developing the art school there now. And some of them are prominent artists, people like even Ebony Patterson. You know, she I recruited along with several others when I taught in France during the summers. I taught special projects in France every summer at the Pontevent School of Contemporary Art. And I recruited and once Jamaicans, you know, if they go abroad, it changes their entire sense of self, because then they're able to look at themselves in a white culture or a black culture in a much more, in a different way than they normally take for granted while they're in a black culture in Jamaica. So that kind of changed their art, inspired them, and they just went on and did great. I don't know. I've been rambling a lot. I don't know if I answered any questions.
No. You're answering the questions that I had in mind, so I don't even need to ask the questions, actually. But going back to your work, what we see right now at the gallery in Boston, how has your work changed over the years? Like the main concerns of your work or even the styles? I mean, does your work as a professor and the lectures and stuff help your art practice, or how does it influence it or hurt it? What do you think?
Well, it hurts sometimes throughout the years in my art practice, from the standpoint of the time I need to dedicate to making art and their personal images or imagery, which I long for. I have this longing, as well as my entire sociological status context as a black artist living in a very white, predominantly white culture. I have many stories I'd like to tell with my work, not only that of the poetics of space and the poetic language of aesthetics and so on. I do have also language that and content that might be of a more political level, which I remember doing a number of those in my earlier work. And I feel as if I understand certain aspects of culture a lot more now where I've lived And I feel as if I want to, I've had this longing to kind of, to reform and to restructure and my language, my aesthetic and communicative language to express ideas about Black people a lot more directly. I've been thinking about that a lot lately, even though I'm working abstractly, and I've been working abstractly for a good 10 years now. One of the unfinished work I think I have is having gone to Africa, you know, spent time. I spent a couple of my sabbaticals in Ghana and Senegal. I did a series of work based on rituals, rituals directly related to Akan religion and dance, and the objects, the ritual objects they use. And those works were pleased me a lot, and I felt a sense of connecting with my own self and history. That theme, I think, has never been completed, and I feel still they haunt me, and I always want to go back to that theme. And I remember also doing a series of painting called Artists Eat and Paint, which was a way of metaphorically talking about existence, survival, about the cliche of artists, hungry artists, the idea of who is actually eating. Specifically, I wanted to suggest something about Black artists. The fact that Black artists in America, African-American artists in general, and artists of color have not been recognized for many, many years for the kind of tremendous amount of work that they have done, as well as contribution that they have made to society, and how the museum lack a certain sense of continuity in their critical analysis of art history. The standpoint of being North America or going beyond North America, going to South America, looking at. And so for me, I felt as if as a professor, I was kind of relearning academically, studying myself constantly through my travels. And I wasn't dependent on necessarily just the books stocked up in the conventional library. The idea of having my body move in different spaces would inform me very differently from what the books say, or what white historians have always written about Black people and their experience. And it turned out to be true. I mean, I did experience a lot. I feel more confident and clear. Much of what I learned in the first undergraduate year in school is quite, you know, for me, some of it is just Mickey Mouse. But the real thing, the real deal is, I think, is when I traveled to Africa. I traveled to places like West Asia, Turkey. I spent time in Turkey, Istanbul, Izmir, Kushidasi, Babylus, are parts of the border of Iran. You learn something else about Black people in that world. That, you know, the way people talk in the West, the Western canonized idea of history is just so pathetic at times. And a lot of history will have to be rewritten, a lot of art criticism, a lot of the revisionism that is going on now by our many African-American artists and artists of color are now, is going to like change the entire academic structure for the future of the generations learning about art, period. So I feel as if I've been involved in that in a quiet way, you know, in my own way, and I don't depend on finance always from arts organization necessarily. I just works I sell and I use a chunk of my salary. I use that to travel and discover. And I have a family now, so you know, my son, my wife has been very helpful. She's Chinese. She's from Shanghai, and Shanghai people see themselves as significantly a kind of a special kind of Chinese.
Much more culture.
And it's
true,
it's a fact. And she is well versed with Western culture, you know, Caribbean culture. And she, her job herself, used to deal with a lot of travel throughout Europe and North America as a manager in Siemens. my son, whom I'm bringing up, yeah. I'm bringing him up to understand something about East, West, North, South, to understand, you know, a bigger picture, and to be a linguist in his own sense, learning other languages other than English, because the English-speaking world is mm-hmm. the smallest part of the world anywhere. The biggest part of the world are non-English speaking in terms of population. And that's important to also recognize. But anyway, and that, you know, that says something about how facts are taught. We know facts always from English, but we don't know the facts coming Absolutely. From other places that are non-English speaking, which shows there's a certain serious lack in our perspective, and we as individuals or Black people, we need to kind of be aware of that and go beyond the pale, go a little more beyond what we're always being washed with.
Yes. Well, this exhibition goes until March 27th.
Right? Yeah, it goes until March 27th. I've had some, I was a Boston artist, or the choice. I was artist of Critics' Choice recently, I think this past Friday for the Boston Globe. And,
oh, that's
cool. And, you know, a lot of people have been coming to the exhibition. The director of the Museum of Fine Arts, Matthew Teitelbaum, came to the exhibition too, and we had some long chats, and, you know, that was wonderful. Because he's, you know, respect him a lot as an art scholar and a person who has been director of museum both in Canada and now at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Edmund Barragesa, who has been my mentor for many years, he has been very helpful in kind of shaping my vision intellectually, especially towards how I understand this body of work deriving from earlier work into this kind of theme. And of course, I will move this theme out of maybe the more abstract propensity into a much more maybe figurative, because I think I need to go back in a little more figurative to touch on certain issues that I think is happening in Jamaican society, as well as, you know, North America, since I've lived here for a while.
Yes.
I actually strayed away from your question. Sorry.
No, it's okay. I mean, basically, I was going to ask you what you're going to work on next, but you answered that already. Yeah, are you going to stay in Boston for a while, or do you have plans to travel somewhere else? Or where do you think you're going to do this new body of work?
I still have my student in Beijing. And so it's a studio that I've a lot of my major work, and I want to go back there and spend a few months finishing up some theme, because a museum there had invited me to show, which was cancelled, and I'm just trying to get that opportunity back again. I've shown at a few museums in China, including solo exhibitions. So in that sense, I kind of want some continuity with my more recent work there and the support that they give me. Continuing this body where I've been thinking about Africa. I think about Kalinde Wiley's residency that he has in Senegal somewhere now. I really kind of, I've been thinking about Africa, especially with the recent onslaught on the protests that have happened in this country.
Yes.
I feel as if geographically there'll be a shift. There'll be at some point a tectonic shift. And it's boiling over, and a lot of people are trying to suppress it. But I think that is the next kind of, and I think art will have to somewhat embody and somewhat to acknowledge some of what that means for Black artists, what it means for artists of color, their different vision, the kind of refresh ideas that they have, as opposed to a lot of the same old boring stuff that sometimes we've seen in their westernized society. You know,
I know what you mean.
People probably has a lot to say now. A lot of us have been suppressed. Yeah.
Well, that stuff is also made that way because the market recognizes it and it's palatable to them, so it sells, and therefore they show that stuff.
Yeah, that's right. I think in a way, you know, there will be an expansion of ideas and imagery, and I can see a number of, I'm very excited about a lot of what artists of color have been doing recently.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the progress that they've been making. And I do feel truly a sort of optimism about what they will be doing in the future. And I've been trying to keep in touch with some of, you know, what artists are doing in Europe, artists of color, what they're doing in South America, what they're doing in China.
Yes.
There are a few artists of color in China here and there.
Yes.
You know, I'm not afraid of a big, gigantic country because there's immensity and minuteness. I think a minute, you know, as much as I'm from Jamaica, Jamaica is a culture, a cultural superpower. It has Bob Marley. It has changed the world a lot in its thinking.
Yes.
It has Marcus Garvey. It has, mm-hmm. So I don't think of myself as from a small island. I really think it's the immensity of thought and ideas and expansion, how you expand that. Through your communication and existence.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else you wanted to add before we end our call?
Well, I mean, you know, if there are, you know, there are any kind of, I think it's wonderful that you are also, you have done such work for years to kind of enhance the lives of artists, and I hope you continue doing it. I think that's really important. Independent curators like yourself, I think, needs and communicators need to exert a lot more presence in the, you know, the art world, because it does give a whole different perspective that people are yearning for. And basically, you know, if there are collectors also want to collect the work, they can always check the gallery or check myself.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, I put the galleries, your website, actually, I put your website in the description of the episode so people can go there and get more info about you, about the show, and about the gallery.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
Well, have a good weekend, and hopefully I'll be seeing you soon again. If not in Boston, then in New York or somewhere.
Yes, I hope so, and thank you very much. And I hope if there's any other thing, you know, for this interview, feel free to contact me. Help us.
Yes. All the best to you and your family.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode with Brian McFarlane, and if you're in Boston, by all means, please go see his exhibition at the Naga Gallery. There's information about how to find Brian's work online in the description of this episode. Stay well and enjoy the wonderful spring weather.